Good afternoon. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, and welcome back to HealthCetera, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. I'm Kenya Beard, one of the co-producers of this program. I'm delighted to be here today to explore a simple yet complicated question. How knowledgeable are you? Think about it. If you had to rate your level of knowledge on a scale of 1 to 10, how high would you score if 10 indicated extremely knowledgeable? Now, think about all there is to know in the world, and again, rate how knowledgeable you are. Did your score change? If it did, don't worry, you are not alone. Many people think they know a lot more than they do and offer strong opinions on matters they know relatively little about. Consider how discussions supporting or opposing the Affordable Care Act could result in adrenaline-raising debates. A brief or momentary pause to discuss the details of the ACA and implications of a repeal could silence conversations, or better yet, cause greater confusion. In healthcare, a lack of awareness regarding the limitations of one's knowledge could prove disastrous. So why do individuals overinflate their level of knowledge? Is it because information is just so readily accessible and it is easy to exaggerate what one knows? Well, the delineation between one's own knowledge and that which is borrowed is sometimes blurred. But should we care? Well, besides the embarrassment of offering opinions on matters that reveal the extent of one's explanatory depth, the inherent dangers of the knowledge illusion could range from damaged relationships and stalled policies to something more serious like medical errors and plane crashes. So can a better understanding of the knowledge illusion improve safety? Could it lead to less polarizing debates and spark a more informed discourse? Well, to help us figure out some of these questions, to help us answer some of these questions, I've invited Dr. Stephen Sloman and Philip Fernbeck to the show. Steve and Phil are cognitive scientists and authors of the just-released, soon-to-be bestseller, Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. Steve is a professor at Brown University and the editor-in-chief of the journal Cognition, and Phil is a professor of marketing at the University of Colorado and has a PhD from Brown University in cognitive science. Phil is actually working on a research project that examines the question, what makes us argue so heatedly over things we know so little about? Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us, Kenya. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
First, congratulations on your timely publication, The Knowledge Illusion. This is a must read for anyone who wants to move from individual ignorance to a community of intelligence and basically, I think, become genius. So my first question to you guys, what led you to write a book that basically says, although our mind is both brilliant and pathetic, individuals don't know much, much of what's in their head is superficial, and that we tend to overestimate what we know?
Well, we were inspired in part by work by other psychologists who appreciate that people are just amazingly ignorant in so many ways. Only 43% of the American population can name a single Supreme Court justice. Only 50% of Americans know that antibiotics kill bacteria and not viruses. The list goes on and on. People are just don't know much. Now, we don't really blame people for not knowing much. I mean, there's a lot to know. The world is incredibly complex. But what we do know is that people think they know more than they do. And that's really our concern. And we know this because we've run experiments, and others have run experiments, showing that if you ask people to explain things, even simple things like information reveals to people that they don't understand things as well as they thought, and so their ratings of their own understanding decrease. And we've actually shown in the political domain, if you ask people to explain political policies, not only does that make people's ratings of their own understanding go down, because they realize they can't explain how the policies would lead to outcomes, but it also makes them less confident in their own view. They become less extreme. So as a group, people become less polarized through this act of attempted explanation.
So you're suggesting that people should think about their ability to describe something when asked to rate their knowledge about something. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. You know, there about 70% of people demonstrate what Frank Kyle, the psychologist who first showed this effect, calls the illusion of explanatory depth, and that's what we refer to in the title of our book as the knowledge illusion. Not everybody shows it. And in particular, people who are more reflective, people who think before they speak, don't show the effect. Presumably because when you ask them how well they understand something, they try to explain it before they answer the question and discover they don't have much of an explanation. Things are hard to explain. Even simple things like zippers are complicated. You brought up the Affordable Care Act. That's a 20,000-page document, or over 20,000-page document.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly complicated, and nobody fully understands it.
Good point. So you counter the idiom, both of you counter the idiom, that ignorance is bliss, and that ignorance is inevitable. Help us to understand this knowledge illusion. Now, you alluded a little bit about the whole zipper and the ballpoint pen. Can you speak a little more about that?
Sure. So the idea is that the human mind is really made for collaboration. So it's not made for figuring everything out on our own. And so everything in the world has incredible complexity to it. You think of simple things like a ballpoint pen or a toilet or the kind of things that you deal with in your everyday life. No one individual can master all the details of those kinds of things. And then, like Steve just mentioned, you get into more complicated things like healthcare policy and so on. None of that is possible without the mind being really set up for collaboration. And so as individuals, we're not really made to store a lot of detailed information about the world. We're not made for individual minds to be able to master things. There's just too much to know. What we're really built for is collaboration and thinking as a community. And so that's what really is responsible for this lack of detailed knowledge that we have in our heads.
So if you had skeptics who said, oh, I disagree with this, you know, the human mind is not made for collaboration, what would be some of the inherent dangers of this?
You would get demagogues, like some political leaders around the world. It would indicate that the person doesn't understand how people get by in the world. Some people have become hermits and tried to live and exist by themselves, and often they either don't live very long, or in some famous cases, they end up stealing food from other people because, you know, we just are interdependent. I must say that when we wrote the book, I expected to get a lot of pushback of the form you just described. You know, I expected a lot of people to say, we're wrong, we're underestimating individual intelligence. But we haven't heard a lot of that. You know, even my most brilliant friends who seem to, you know, wax fluently about everything under the sun, even they seem to admit that they feel ignorant and don't know everything. Let me just make one more point. So I don't think the issue is people believing that they know everything so much as acting as if they know everything. and just not appreciating something that they would actually agree to, which if it were pointed out to them, that they don't know everything.
So I totally agree, and I think it goes back to what I had said earlier about the fact that the release of your book, the timing is perfect. I don't think you're going to get a lot of pushback. I actually think that people are probably tired of acting like they know everything. Who, with this technological explosion that we've experienced and we continue to experience, who in their right mind would say that they know everything?
Great point.
Yeah. Well, one of the issues with this explosion of information is that some of the results we documented in the book is the extent to which we can have a kind of contagious understanding where when we have access to information, we kind of feel like that information is in our own heads. And so the internet is a great example of this. So there's some interesting research out there suggesting that merely the act of searching the internet for information makes individuals feel like they themselves know the information, and so that can actually lead to a perverse kind of overconfidence. So this your sort of intuition that the fact that there's so much information out there must make us feel like we don't know, sometimes it's actually quite the opposite. Just because we live in a community of knowledge and we have so much access to information so readily now that it can give us the feeling that we're more knowledgeable than we are.
Oh, definitely.
And just to support that, while I agree completely with you, Kenya, that there are a lot of people who are more than happy to admit their ignorance, it's actually it's freeing, right? It's liberating to feel like you don't have to know everything and to admit to yourself that you're a limited individual. And I agree, a lot of people benefit from that. In fact, we got a note from someone who told us that they had been suffering their entire life with a mental disorder, and it was so satisfying for them to learn that they're not the only person who is ignorant, that everybody, in fact, is ignorant. But, as Phil points out, there's a lot of hubris out there, not just in the White House, although there's plenty in the White House. There are a lot of people who feel like they know what the right answer to all the world's most difficult questions are.
Okay, so yes, would you say that's a degree of arrogance, or is there more that we need to talk about?
So we made the argument that some of this stems from this illusion. People feel like they get it, and that has to do with having access to the information and not really realizing that knowledge is really a community, is really spread across a community. It's not in individuals' heads. Individuals themselves don't know very much, and yet by virtue of participating in that community, we often think we know more than we do. And so that's what gives rise to this hubris, this failure to realize where the source of knowledge actually is.
But what happens when we link that knowledge illusion because of this access to information to a person's personality, and that personality of the person is that they're ignorant, not ignorant, but that they're arrogant? What happens then?
Well, what we're trying to suggest is that the cause of the arrogance is the knowledge illusion, right? That they're feel they understand because they're surrounded by understanding. The understanding isn't in their head. The understanding is mostly in the people around them, and that's why they're arrogant. So what we're suggesting is if we can burst their knowledge illusion by having them explain things, they'll actually become less arrogant.
Okay. So is that going back to that page in your book that talks about if A is B, then B is A?
A is B and B is A. Sorry, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
You have an example in your book when you're talking about causality, and you talk about if A is B, then B is A, but that's not always true. You say that you shower because you fell into a sewer, but you can't say if you fell into a sewer, that meant that you just had to shower, something like that. I forgot. You know
right,
better.
Right.
Correct me. How did you say it exactly?
I'll let him take that one on.
So you're referring to some discussion in the book we have of the kind of logic that the mind uses to process information, and we make the argument that the kind of logic that people use is not sort of the deductive logic of a computer, but is what we call a causal logic, the ability to reason about cause and effect. And so when people think about sort of intuitively about things, they can commit logical fallacies and make errors in that way. And so I think that it is a very human thing is to make kind of logical fallacy type errors. And I think you're right that can lead to a kind of hubris if you feel like you understand an argument that's even logically flawed. One thing I was going to add a second ago that I think is related is that Steve brought up the point, and you talked about arrogance. Steve brought up the point that there is this individual difference that varies across people, which is called cognitive reflection. And cognitive reflection is really the idea that some people are more likely to check that intuitive understanding and stop before they express an opinion and think a little more deeply about some things like that. And people who are more reflective are less susceptible to this illusion of explanatory depth. So I think what you're suggesting is not necessarily that people are more arrogant, but people who are less reflective, that can be a lethal cocktail when it comes to this kind of overconfidence.
Okay.
And another thing to point out is that this cognitive reflection is not the same as intelligence. So you can have smart people who are not very reflective, and that can lead to, you know, people who are traditionally very smart, but might actually be that arrogant type that you talk about because they fail to realize the limits of their own understanding. And that's sort of the lethal cocktail that I think that you might have been referring to.
Okay, good. Good point. I just want to remind our listeners, I'm Kenya Beard, one of the co-producers of HealthCetera, which is brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy. And today we have Stephen Sloman and Philip Fernback. They are cognitive scientists and authors of the just released, soon-to-be bestseller, Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. So my next question, what are some of those, you actually talked about some of the inherent dangers of the illusion and what could happen, but I wanted to move forward and talk about ways that our current society support the knowledge illusion when we don't make it safe to talk about what we don't know.
Yeah, well, that's become a huge problem with the growth of the internet, right? Because we now live in our little social bubbles and we only talk to people who share our point of view, and thus we just get our own perspectives and our own knowledge fed back to us, and we feel like we must understand because we share a point of view with the people that we interact with. And of course, this is made worse by the fact that the major players on the internet, Facebook and Google, like to individualize the information that they give us. So we just see what we want to see, and we fail to see things from a different perspective. And I think, you know, that's a huge problem today, that we tend to live and work within communities of like-minded people. So we just fail to have to grapple with the fact that there are very different perspectives out there. And, you know, that we don't necessarily have direct access to grand truth.
Right.
Let me add that I think another aspect of this is this misconception we have of the mind as this kind of individual entity, when we should really be thinking about communities, leads us to think that individuals, we ourselves, should be kind of masters of everything. And when we look at somebody else who we think of as an expert, we think they know everything. But the reality is that, like we've been talking, individuals don't know very much, and that's totally fine. That's just the nature of things. The world is very complex, and so we often have trouble asking questions because we think we're going to be seen as foolish or ignorant. And so we often get the situation where nobody in the room understands something and nobody's willing to pipe up and actually ask the question because we feel embarrassed because we feel like we should be masters of everything. So if we took a little more of a realistic perspective on the way the mind works and what it's for, we might get better as a society. society at kind of asking questions and explaining things in a way that's actually more comprehensible to people, that might lead to more sort of a beneficial interaction and engagement with one another.
Okay, I think that's true. You know, I do understand that community of like-mindedness, how that can lead us down a path where we become so monolithic. And as a result, especially if we don't allow the opinions of others to make us think broader, that could be pretty dangerous, especially when you think about some of the institutions that we're talking about, healthcare for one. We need people
really
to...
interesting in the healthcare field, right? Healthcare is a domain in which there are so many different theories, there's so many different perspectives. Someone has a problem, some people tell them they should have surgery, and other people tell them they should change their diet, and other people tell them the right exercise program will help. People's advice always comes from their perspective on things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And presumably, there's not a one-size-fits-all solution to medical problems. So that's just a perfect example of a domain in which it's absolutely critical to reach across the bubble to think about perspectives that are different from your own. And it's also a domain that demonstrates how tough that can be, because medical problems are so very complicated. And, you know, I just had a procedure on my hand yesterday for carpal tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was shocked that this surgeon has nothing but hands. That's all he does, right? I mean, he's an incredible expert. He knows a huge amount about the body, but his expertise in all of his procedures are on the hand. So clearly,
lucky for you.
Sorry?
I said, lucky for you.
That I was able to find such a surgeon, you mean?
Yes, definitely.
Because I have insurance. Yes. Yes, absolutely. Lucky for me. I'm a member of that lucky class. Absolutely. But it just goes to show you how knowledge tends to be so local, right? And our expertise is so very limited that if we're going to make big decisions, big policy decisions, or even big decisions about how to treat our bodies, it really requires a huge community of knowledge. It requires expertise from all corners in order to make that decision wisely, and that requires a kind of open-mindedness that we don't often see.
Well, I'm so excited that your book really emphasizes the importance of that community of knowledge, and that we need to come together and listen to the thoughts and opinions of other people and to share our expertise and our knowledge. Right now, we have two political parties with polarizing views. To what extent can understanding the knowledge illusion make debates less polarizing and bring about high-quality healthcare for all individuals at the lowest cost?
I think that is the critical question. That is such an important question. And I think our book does have something to say about that. So the issue is that we get into these very divisive and polarized debates about really complicated issues, and healthcare is really the perfect example of that. If you actually talk to sort of rank-and-file individuals on both sides, they tend to not be dramatically different in terms of the outcomes that they want. Everybody wants affordable health care and good outcomes, and they want to be healthy and happy. And yet, when we get into these debates, we tend to simplify the two sides of the debate in a way that makes them seem very, very different from one another. We think about our fundamental values when it comes to the debate instead of thinking about what are the likely outcomes of different kinds of policy around healthcare. And the truth is that policy around healthcare is really complicated. And so anybody telling you that this change in policy is necessarily and definitely going to change, going to result in a certain kind of outcome is not being completely honest. So one thing that we found in studies is that if we get people to think about that complexity and to think about those outcomes and the consequences of policy, as opposed to thinking about those fundamental values that seem very black and white, then it opens people's minds a little bit. They realize that things are a little bit more complicated, and actually the two sides might not be so far apart in terms of what the values are that they bring to the table and what they want to accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, it's a deep and difficult question, right? Because I do think there are fundamental differences in values. I mean, some people are just allergic to the notion of the government influencing our health care, and others just care about providing universal health coverage for everybody. And sometimes, you know, we have to admit that sometimes those values conflict. So it may be the case that there's not one remedy for everybody, but Phil's point is right on the money, that there are lots of points of agreement. You know, we all agree, I think, that it's good to reduce the cost of health care. We all agree that it's good to provide more health coverage to more people. And so if we just focus on those points of agreement, then hopefully we can accomplish something.
Yeah, but I stand by the point that I think that the way that we engage in the debate actually makes the differences seem more stark than they are in terms of the values.
Right.
If you talk to a typical Republican or Democrat and you say, like, should there be a government takeover of healthcare, you'll get dramatically different answers. But if you explain the true policy in more nuance and explain, you know, the historical context and the extent to which government has been involved in healthcare for a very long time, then you get things that are much more moderate, I think. And yes, there are people on both sides that are on the extremes. There are people who say that the healthcare system should be completely in the hands of the private sector, and some people who say that it should be completely European style single payer or government healthcare and so on. But typical voters, I don't think, have those really strong ideological commitments. What they tend to want to do is to optimize on certain kinds of outcomes. And so I think the way we engage in that debate to say, like, oh, this is government versus this is free handouts for everybody or whatever it is, when we talk about it in that way, it makes the differences seem really stark. And from my conversations with people across the aisle, it's typically that caricature is not that accurate.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that if we explain the historical context, that will broaden understanding and views will be less polarizing, as opposed to talking about values and playing on people's emotions, which will support polarization.
I think that's right. Not just the historical context, but just talking about the mechanics of how it works, I think, is really important. The historical context is important, too. But what we don't do enough of is actually sit down and say, what are the consequences here?
Right.
How is this going to work? And what are the consequences in terms of how many people are going to be covered? What's going to happen to costs and so on? Typically, what we get is a very simplistic over-exaggeration of the policy, a demagoguing of the issue. So if we sat and talked a little more rationally about what truly are the costs and benefits, I mean, all healthcare policy involves trade-offs, right? And often what people who are trying to be up for re-election or trying to get elected in their districts, they tend not to like to talk about trade-offs. They like to say, follow my plan and everything's going to be perfect and it's not going to cost you anything and it's going to be great. But all health policy involves talking about trade-offs. And
right.
So we should be able to have more rational conversations about that. And I think that people on both sides kind of want to optimize on the same things a lot of the time. Not always. Steve is absolutely right that sometimes we have values that differ, and those are harder cases. But I think getting in the habit of talking more about the mechanics and the outcomes and the trade-offs is really important, as opposed to talking about our values.
So, the problem that arises when you do that is you very quickly become very boring, right?
That's right.
You sound like a policy wonk, and it's conventional wisdom that the electorate doesn't want to listen to policy wonks. They don't want to hear a complicated discussion about the ins and outs of this or that policy. So, you know, in a sense, that is the problem. How do you be a policy wonk and yet remain interesting and yet talk to people about things that they care about. You know, and it is possible. I mean, I think that Bill Clinton was great at that. I think Barack Obama was great at that. But you do have to admit at some point that the individual member of the electorate is just not going to understand all the details because they're too complicated. Just like I don't fully understand the ballpoint pen, right? Not every American citizen is going to understand Obamacare. So there has to be an appeal to expertise.
Yes, right? But there should be a way to simplify it as well.
There are ways to simplify it, but it's very easy to oversimplify, right?
Right.
And what's important is to mark the distinction between simplifying what the effect of a policy would be versus talking about something which is really simple, which is what your values are. That's what politicians love to do.
Right.
Right? They just immediately retreat to claims about what's important instead of simplifying the mechanics of the problem.
I think there's a difference. You know, as researchers, we're required to consider implications and we have to justify everything. Whereas, you know, with the political climate, you know, we're saying that the culture really doesn't allow that. You know, you're saying we don't want to hear the consequences. We want to just talk about the values and what we attach to.
That comes back to sort of full circle to where we started, which is that people tend to take in the world in kind of a simplistic manner. We don't notice all of this complexity, and so that's what people like to hear, because when you talk about your fundamental values, the issue seems simple, and when you talk about all that complexity, it seems complex, and complexity is hard to deal with.
You're so right. Any parting comments?
I'm so glad that you're bringing this issue up in the context of the healthcare debate. It's the perfect forum for trying to understand the issues that our book is about and for trying to make a positive difference. And so I thank you for that.
You're quite
Absolutely.
Welcome.
It's been great to be here and have this conversation with you. Thanks so much.
Okay, and you're welcome. A couple of takeaways. One, we know that we don't understand consequences. We tend to connect to values. We can easily disabuse people of their illusion. We learn best when we think with others, and we must think counterfactually. Those are some of the takeaways that I took away from your book. To bring about a healthcare bill that improves the quality of healthcare and makes it more accessible and affordable for everyone, this is going to require someone whose intelligence is at the level of genius. And I say genius because it's going to require someone who's not just smart, but someone who has that level of emotional intelligence as well. So when we think about that, we know that individuals will have to work collectively and appreciate the limits of their knowledge. So I want to thank you guys. I want to thank our listeners for joining us today on HealthCetera. Thank our guests, Steve and Phil. Make sure you pick up a copy of The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone, and gain wisdom by connecting with others. Phil and Steve, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Kenya. Thanks. It's been a pleasure.